First Radio Durb broadcast of the decade. That was one of Franz Joseph Haydn's Derbyshire Marches, and this is your perennially genial host, John Derbyshire, with the news of the hour. Lots to report this week, so let's get into it.
Not negotiating behind closed doors, but bringing all parties together broadcasting those negotiations on C-SPAN so that the American people can see what the choices are. Because part of what we have to do is enlist the American people in this process.
Yes, that was our president on the campaign trail 2 years ago. And that was no off-the-cuff remark either. It was a campaign theme. Here he was a few days later.
But these negotiations will be on C-SPAN. And so the public will be part of the conversation and will see the choices that are being made.
And then in March of 08.
We're going to do all these negotiations on C-SPAN.
Now, April.
All this will be done on C-SPAN.
Continuing on to May.
But I want the negotiations to be taking place on C-SPAN.
Fast forward to August.
We'll have the negotiations televised on C-SPAN.
On to November 08, when he'd already been elected.
You know, I respect what the Clintons tried to do in 1993 in moving health reform forward. But they made one really big mistake, and that is they took all their people and all their experts into a room, and then they closed the door. We will work on this process publicly. It'll be on C-SPAN. It will be streaming over the net.
And once again, later in November.
And we will have a public process for forming this plan. It'll be televised on C-SPAN. I can guarantee it'll be exciting.
So, with all these promises of openness and C-SPAN coverage, this final stage of the healthcare bill, the reconciliation of the House and Senate bills, should be quite a show, right? No. The committee proceedings to finalise the bill will not be televised, we've been told. Now, OK, politicians say all sorts of stuff when they're campaigning, and nobody who's graduated fifth grade should believe more than half of it. Still, Obama was awfully insistent about this one. And this is no ordinary politician. This is Barack Obama, redeemer of America's political soul, tribune of the people, beacon of hope and change, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, and altogether the most wonderful person ever to attain the presidency, if not the most wonderful person that ever lived. The reason he was so insistent on openness in the production of a healthcare bill was, as he made clear, to prevent the health insurance and drug companies from working their will against the interests of ordinary folk. We all know, of course, that capitalism is evil, that big corporations are endlessly scheming to destroy our health, loot our bank accounts and undermine our rights, and that only the fearless actions of those brave progressive souls willing to stand up and speak truth to power, people like, say, Barack Obama, prevent us from being poisoned, bankrupted and enslaved by the satanic machinations of Blue Cross and Pfizer Inc. Still, the question must be asked. If Barack Obama of 2008 was so insistent on openness in order to prevent big corporations from having their way behind closed doors, who will be having their way behind the closed doors of congressional committee rooms when the health care bill is finalized? Barack Obama isn't the only one whose pants have been on fire lately, of course. There has also been Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, the Nigerian guy who tried to blow up a plane with a bomb in his underwear on Christmas Day. Instead of exploding, the bomb burst into flames. Captain Underpants is now in federal custody and getting treatment for what are called severe burn injuries. You have to wonder what that means in terms of Mr. Abdulmutallab's future contributions to the gene pool, but let's not dwell on that. As Radio Derb goes to tape, the President has just made public a report on the whole incident, but it didn't tell us anything that hadn't already been leaked. Plainly, the US visa system is just as screwed up as it was when Mohammed Atta's visa approval came through 6 months after 9/11. Plainly, it will be this screwed up forever. The federal government has long since reached a plateau of incompetence. They'll never get any better, though we shouldn't, in all prudence, bet on their not getting worse. These bureaucrats and time servers would issue a visa to Osama bin Laden if he showed up and wave him through airport security while pulling aside your grandmother for a full strip search. It's nice that the President has seen fit to offer us some information, though, even if he doesn't intend to do us the same favour on the healthcare bill. Well, what have we learned from this Captain Underpants incident? For one thing, it's clear that Mr. Abdulmutallab's inspiration came from radical cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, the same guy who was sending email instructions to the Fort Hood assassin, Nidal Hassan, and who described Hassan's actions as, quote, courageous. Al-Awlaki is a U.S. citizen, born here in 1971 when his father was a student in New Mexico. He himself has a degree in civil engineering from Colorado State University and a master's in education at San Diego State. One thing that's clear here is that these jihadis are not the wretched of the earth. Far from it. Abdulmutallab's dad is a wealthy banker. Hassan is a professional psychiatrist. Osama bin Laden himself comes from a very wealthy family. The jihadis are driven by hatred of the West. They hate us because their allegiance is to Islam, and Islam, Islamic culture, Islamic nations, Islamic armies, are repeatedly humiliated by the West. In the first Gulf War, the body count came out as 134 dead allies, 20,000 dead Iraqis. That's a fair quantitative measure of the success of Islamic societies compared with Western ones. If you're a Muslim, it's humiliating. To really feel that humiliation, to really feel the burn of it, you need to have some education, some close acquaintance with the Western world, some knowledge of history and current affairs, and some insight into how the corrupt, semi-westernized rulers of places like Saudi Arabia actually live. Attending a Western university and listening to radical professors talk about the evils of capitalism and colonialism probably helps a lot too. Peasants and goat herds don't have that sort of knowledge. They'll fight for their tribe or their chieftain, but they're not likely as crazy as the educated jihadis who've been giving us so much trouble lately. The Center for Defense Information, a military think tank, estimates that we shall spend $300 billion this year in military operations against the peasants and goat herds of Afghanistan, people who would leave us alone if we left them alone. That's $820 million a day. Meanwhile, in Texas and New Mexico, in Minneapolis and Virginia, in London and Manchester, a new generation of jihadis is being recruited. Here's another one. Humam Khalil Abu Mulal al-Balawi. That was the 32-year-old Jordanian doctor who blew up himself and seven of our people at a CIA base in Afghanistan last week. Yep, a doctor. Al-Balawi got pulled in by the Jordanian police for making jihadi propaganda. Somehow, he got the police to believe they had turned him to help them against Al-Qaeda, specifically to help them find the number two in the organization, Egyptian-born Ayman al-Zawahiri, also a doctor as it happens. I tell you, this whole jihad business is a very bourgeois operation. A working-class lad like me probably wouldn't get through the door. Anyway, al-Balawi went off to Pakistan and Afghanistan as a double agent, claiming he would gather information on al-Qaeda and pass it to the CIA. He was, in fact, a triple agent, passing on our intelligence data and codes and methods to al-Qaeda, while building up trust so he could get close enough to kill some of our key personnel. It all worked brilliantly. The level of trust was so high that al-Balawi was not even patted down as he walked into a top-level meeting at the CIA Afghan base. The deputy station chief for the whole of Afghanistan was there, along with the agency's two leading experts on jihadi operations. All three were killed, along with four other security experts. The Times of London reports that the meeting was expected to be of such substance that it was to be followed by a call to President Obama. Now, we not only face the loss of much of our own expertise, we also have to figure out how much al-Balawi passed on to al-Qaeda and how many other people we think are agents are actually double agents and how many we think are double agents are, like al-Balawi, actually triple agents. Mr. Balawi's wife, a journalist living in Istanbul, interviewed by a Turkish news agency, delivered herself of the following tribute, quote, "I am proud of him. My husband has carried out a great operation in such a war. May God accept his martyrdom." End quote. Meanwhile, we can add Captain Underpants, the Christmas Day bomber, to the roll call of terrorists who graduated from British universities, along with Ahmed Omar Saeed Sheikh, who murdered Daniel Pearl, and who was a graduate of the London School of Economics, and the London bus bomber Mohammed Siddiq Khan, University of Leeds, Kafil Ahmed, who blew himself up at Glasgow Airport, he was a Cambridge graduate, and Omar Rayman, currently serving 15 years for conspiracy to blow up several British and American targets. He's a graduate of the University of Westminster. Irish historian Ruth Dudley Edwards had a devastating piece in the January 2nd Daily Telegraph, detailing the huge jihadist presence in British universities and the efforts the jihadis make to recruit freshmen to the cause. If a right-wing reactionary like myself or Pat Buchanan were to attempt to give a public talk at a British university, we should be tarred and feathered and run out past the porter's lodge on a rail. But every glittery-eyed fascist with a beard and an Arabic name is an honoured guest behind those ivy-covered walls. And anyone who objects will be attended to by the British police, who nowadays spend most of their time enforcing political correctness. The CIA has in fact told the White House that the single biggest threat of another 9/11 scale attack comes from some British-born Pakistani extremist entering the US under the visa waiver program between Britain and the US. The CIA has a huge operation in Britain, monitoring thousands of Islamic extremists identified by MI5, Britain's own security service. The Daily Telegraph reported last year that, quote, around 40% of CIA activity on homeland threats is now in the UK, end quote. These born-in-the-West Muslims are the most dangerous of all. They feel like misfits in the country of their birth. Yet if they go back to the native village in Pakistan or Yemen, they're out of place there too. Lost and rootless, they need a home, and Al-Qaeda offers one. As I have mentioned before, Captain Underpants graduated from the same London college I did, only 40 years later. When I graduated, there were no Islamic prayer rooms, no visiting imams, no Islamic presence at all that I was aware of. How did things get to this point? How? By mass immigration, that's how. Mass Third World immigration into Britain began soon after World War II, when a ship named Empire Windrush arrived at London docks bearing 500 immigrants from Jamaica. That was 1948. Immigration of Muslims from Pakistan came slightly later, in the 1950s, the peak years being 1961 and 1962. There were only 10,000 Muslims in Britain in 1955. Now there are 2 million, half of them British-born. Whole neighbourhoods of historic British towns and cities are solidly Muslim. Most are, of course, pleasant enough people, but it's a lot of water for the jihadist fish to swim in. Allowing Muslim settlement in such numbers was a really stupid policy. Didn't anyone spot this at the time? Well, yes, plenty of people did. We learned this week that one of those people was Margaret Thatcher. The deliberations of the British government are made public after 30 years, so we are just getting a close look at papers from the early Thatcher administration. Margaret Thatcher came to power in May of 1979. 2 months later, in a cabinet meeting, the issue of Vietnamese boat people came up. One of Maggie's colleagues suggested taking 10,000 of them. Maggie said there were already too many people coming into Britain. Then a different colleague said he'd got a lot of letters favouring acceptance of the boat people. Well, replied the Iron Lady, the people who'd written those letters should be invited to accept refugees into their homes. In other remarks, she said she thought it quite wrong that immigrants should be given public housing ahead of British people, and that Poles, Hungarians and white Rhodesians were less objectionable because they could more easily be assimilated into British society. It's astonishing to think that just 30 years ago, before multiculturalism fixed its grip on the throat of the West, a national leader could speak such frank good sense. A year and a half earlier, in fact, when she was only leader of the opposition, Maggie had told a TV interviewer that, quote, "People are afraid that this country might be swamped by people with a different culture. We are not in politics to ignore people's worries. We're in politics to deal with them." End quote. That statement was widely credited with killing off the electoral prospects of the crypto-fascist National Front, which had been making progress among voters through the 1970s. Nowadays, no British politician would dare to speak as frankly as Maggie. They are all thoroughly PC-whipped. And, nowadays, the crypto-fascist British National Party, successor to the National Front, is climbing steadily up in the opinion polls. They got 1 million votes in the Euro elections last year. Citizens want to hear what politicians have to say about immigration, multiculturalism and citizenship. If mainstream politicians are too shy to say anything at all, people will turn to those who are less shy. Fascism is the bastard child of political correctness. Maggie understood that. She was the last major politician on either side of the Atlantic that did. One What do present-day Americans think about immigration? Well, the pollsters have been asking them. Once again, as noted many times before, the thing that leaps out from the pollsters' numbers here is the complete disconnect between elites and commoners. The poll I'm actually looking at here was done by Zogby for the Center for Immigration Studies, released a few days ago. It was done among people who attend church or synagogue regularly, and the numbers are broken out by confession. Here's a sample question. Quote, do you support or oppose reducing the illegal immigrant population over time by enforcing existing immigration laws, such as requiring employers to verify the legal status of workers, increasing border enforcement, and more cooperation with local law enforcement? End quote. That's the question. Support or oppose attrition by strict enforcement of current laws? Okay, what did people say? Respondents could strongly support, somewhat oppose, or strongly oppose. I'll just give you the strongly support numbers by confession. Catholics, 68%. Mainline Protestants, 69%. Born-again Protestants, 78%. Jews, 50%. This is the position that liberals denounce as nativist, discriminatory, racist, and the rest of it. It is the position the current administration, like the previous one, will not touch with a 10-foot pole. And it is the opposite of the position taken by church leaders. Last year, the National Association of Evangelicals adopted a resolution calling for amnesty for illegal immigrants. The United Methodist Church, which is the largest of the mainline Protestant churches, just last May called for a pathway to citizenship for illegals. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has a website where they demand a, quote, broad-based legalization for, quote, immigrants without proper documentation. The Episcopal Church asked for the same thing at its General Convention last July. The Union for Reform Judaism wants amnesty and big increases in legal immigration. The United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism likewise. They are a signatory, along with many other religious groups, to the Interfaith Statement in Support of Comprehensive Immigration Reform, which I will leave you to Google for yourself. And so on and so on. Down in the church and synagogue congregations, 50, 60, 70% strongly support attrition through enforcement of current laws. If you throw in the somewhat support respondents, you have great thumping majorities. Up there among the bishops and the chief rabbis, however, the call is for amnesty. Well, perhaps it's time for a reformation. Some magazine named International Living, and no, I never heard of it either, but they have published a list of the best places in the world to live. This strikes me as being based on some loaded assumptions. Best places for who to live? Best place for a couch potato government worker running out the clock to his retirement package? Best place for an imaginative entrepreneur with a great idea for a business startup? Best place for a research scientist? Best place for a conservative political commentator? Best place for a career criminal? Best place for a radical Islamist looking to organize an Al-Qaeda cell? Best place for who? Well, anyway, here's the list, for what it's worth. Number one, France. I'm going to be about the 200,000th person to point out that France, would indeed be a very lovely country, if only it were not inhabited by the French. Number two is Australia, which I guess is fine, if you don't mind people talking through their noses and saying things like, "Fair suck on the old sauce bottle there, Bluey." Number three is Switzerland. Number four, Germany. Number five, New Zealand. So what have we got in that top five? We've got the country that started World War II, the country that surrendered to them, first chance it got, the country that stayed out, and two distant allies. There's a moral there somewhere. Where's the USA? Oh, here we are, number seven, just above Belgium. Belgium? Come on. Italy's at number 10, Austria at number 13, and poor old Britain's down at number 25, six places below Uruguay. So, winning World War II really worked out great, didn't it? Now, I'm taking the whole thing with a pinch of salt. I've been around magazine journalism a bit, and let me tell you, there's an awful lot of magazines run by 23-year-old journo school graduates with ponytails, Birkenstocks, mountain bikes, and the collected works of Leon Trotsky on their bookshelf at home. I'm sticking with the USA, although I'll admit I'm getting more and more curious about Uruguay. Here is Radio Derb's traditional closing miscellany of brief items. Item. They have a neat law in one of the Swiss cantons allowing courts to scale fines according to the offender's income. Thus we read that an unnamed millionaire who was caught doing 85 miles an hour down a village street was issued a speeding ticket for $290,000. Switzerland doesn't sound so bad. Six-figure speeding tickets? Minaret bans? What's not to like? Where were they on that list of best countries? Number three, yeah, I'm willing to believe that one. Item, the administration's dream of making America hospital to the whole world took another advance last week when President Obama announced an end to the 22-year ban on people with AIDS coming here. Way back in the Ellis Island era, immigrants were checked for serious health problems and sent back on the next boat if unfit. Now, however, our nation is so rich and so well supplied with doctors, nurses, hospitals and clinics that we can take in all the world's invalids and treat them on the public fisc. Of course, we shall be even better equipped to do so when the President's healthcare bill emerges from those locked and bolted committee rooms. Item, the city of Chicago, like every other jurisdiction, has had terrible problems with the examinations it gives to prospective hires and promotions in its police and fire services. The problems are, of course, that black and Hispanic candidates pass the exams at much lower rates than white or Asian candidates. That opens up the city agencies to disparate impact lawsuits, alleging that the tests are somehow unfair to minorities. One way out of that used to be to just stiff the white candidates by invalidating the test results and hiring or promoting by race. But that avenue was closed down last year by the Supreme Court in the Ritchie versus DiStefano decision. Another strategy is to dumb down the tests so much that well nigh everyone passes, and then just apply your race quotas. Chicago has already gone down that road as far as it can without looking totally ridiculous, though. Chicago's last fire and police tests back in 2006 were passed by 85% of applicants who walked in off the street. From my own estimate of the kind of people who walk in off Chicago streets, that's pretty scary already. Now, Chicago Police Department is contemplating the one option left to them, scrapping examinations completely. It seems logical to me, well, by Chicago standards at least.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town, toddling town.
Item. In Nevada, as everyone knows, prostitution is legal. You can, for example, check into the Shady Lady Ranch up there by Beatty in the high desert. You can check in, I'm just reading this information off their website, you can check in for the January special, 40 minutes with an associate for only $180. Well, the Shady Lady has just got approval from the County Licensing and Liquor Board to start servicing women as well as men. Jim Davis, proprietor of the Shady Lady, said they could have their first stud on staff in as little as 2 weeks. I wonder what the hiring process is there. Let's hope there are no issues of disparate impact. Item, how are things in Glockamara? Well, they're fine as long as you watch your tongue. On January 1st, Ireland's new blasphemy law took effect. Under this law, a person can be fined up to $35,000 if, quote, he or she publishes or utters matter that is grossly abusive or insulting in relation to matters held sacred by any religion, thereby causing outrage among a substantial number of the adherents of that religion, end quote. The blasphemy law is nothing to do with bolstering Ireland's status of the land of saints and scholars. It is a sop to Muslims, a sort of modern Danegeld. Blogger Andy Ross points out that all the Irish need to do to advertise the absurdity of this law is to start a new religion that requires its members to proclaim statements which other religions condemn as blasphemous. Item, a late footnote to my earlier segment on attitudes to immigration among believers. At least one prince of the church is getting the message. George Carey, former Archbishop of Canterbury, had an op-ed in Thursday's London Times calling for lower levels of immigration and for immigrants to respect British culture, history and the established church. Well, thanks for that, Arch. Better late than never, I suppose. Item, this year is divisible by 10, so we get a census, with all the controversy and rancour that brings along. It started already. Arabs want to have their own race category, instead of being counted as white. Immigrants from Mexico and Central America, who identify with their particular Indian tribe, Maya, Mixtec, Zapotec, Nahua, etc., will be allowed to so list themselves on the census form. It turns out there are a lot of these, quote, indigenous immigrants in the USA. 30% of California farm workers, we're told. Many of them can't even speak Spanish. And then there's the scandal about the race box marked, quote, black, African-American or Negro. Apparently the word Negro is unacceptable nowadays. Who knew? I hope somebody tells the United Negro College Fund. Yes, census time is fun time for those of us who enjoy watching the PC enforcers play Twister. Item. Here's a person who's heeded my call to get a government job. Amanda Simpson, just appointed as a senior technical advisor in the Department of Commerce's Bureau of Industry and Security. The newsworthiness here is that Amanda used to be Mitch. She changed her sex and became Amanda. This makes her the first person to serve in an administration position by presidential appointment after changing sex. I'm fine with it, and I wish her luck. I just wish I could believe that this nation needs a Commerce Department with an $8 billion budget. There we are, ladies and gents. I'm going to sign off this week with something a little different. To relieve you of some of the stress built up from all those stories about the underwear bomber, here is the great English countertenor, Alfred Deller, with his son Mark, singing Purcell's Sound of the Trumpet. I don't know why this came to mind, but it's a lovely piece of vocal music, and I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.